The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
So you're gonna walk out on me?
No, Eddie. You walked out on me. Women are weak and men are strong. My mother wasted a lifetime of strength trying to prove that. Goodbye, Eddie.
Hey everyone, it's another Loose Cannons podcast coming at ya. Today we're going to be discussing 1937's Mannequin, directed by Frank Borsage, not to be confused with the Kim Cattrall 1980s comedy, or to be confused with it, whichever is your preference.
Yep. Andrew
speaking
McCarthy.
Speaking of deep-seated confusion, you can always visit our website at loosecannons.net and find all of our content there, from podcasts to writings to videos to lists of things that Basil likes and doesn't like about movies,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes
yep.
just likes or just doesn't likes,
yeah.
or sometimes nothing to do with the movie whatsoever, like that he got up and got a beer during the film.
Sometimes context is important.
That says something about the movie. I feel like I need to drink during it.
It made you thirsty for alcohol.
I need to poison myself while I'm watching this.
This movie wants to make me yeah. I want to die a little faster. That's what I wanted to say.
But just a specific part of my body. Speaking of Basil, he's joining us today.
Yeah.
So am I. Ruben, also along for the ride. Patrick.
Yep, Patrick's here.
And
hello.
Ilya. Core 4, back at it again.
Ilya from his new location that looks
hell
like
yeah.
just...
It's
a
just,
creepy padded
it's just
room.
Nothing. No, actually, there's the room.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I was just gonna go with like dorm room. Like, Ilya's a freshman and
yeah.
undergraduate again.
Finally living in the broom closet, like I always wanted.
Where's your really shitty bunk yeah. bed that you're sharing nope. with another grown man?
I'm actually sitting in the little part of my apartment where the table fits. So it's like weirdly like a little box in which I'm sitting right now, which
nice.
From which definitely yeah. I, next time I'll pick a nicer location from which to podcast,
like your office.
I know the viewers definitely care about look the viewing audience definitely cares about that.
Oh yeah,
they can hear the difference.
Whether
technically
whether
the viewing audience is
yeah.
us.
Yeah,
I was gonna say
exactly.
whether they're viewers, we'll table that. We'll come back to that later.
Anyways, now we'd like to do a little segment we call Heralds and Denouncements. Been a long time since I gave it 100%.
Oh yeah,
so
it has been a long time. We hit it hard today.
Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. What a good song.
Okay, I don't have anything to herald or denounce. I've watched some movies,
peep.
But they were just okay. I would like to herald being very busy, though, because...
I like it when we herald abstract concepts.
Yeah.
you can also denounce models canceling.
Well, yeah, I can denounce that, too. But, I mean, that just means I end up, like, with different things to do that day. So, it actually, like... I actually ended up filming a video for someone's, like they're entering a painting contest, and so they needed to like film a short interview with themselves and then show them painting. So I was like, all right, I'll do this thing that I've never done before. Awesome.
Woo.
Got some filmmaking practice, a little interviewing practice, so nice. That's good for potential, you know, documentary work in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Silver linings and whatnot.
Yep.
Silver linings, Patrick.
The silver linings, Pat book.
Basil?
I'll go ahead and denounce a movie called Solace, which I watched last night. As I was telling Ruben while I was watching it, it might be the objectively worst movie that I've seen with major actors in it. It's, wow. Got Anthony Hopkins, Colin Farrell, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, Abbie Cornish, several other recognizable people, and I was like, wow, this is a lot of people. I mean, none of them are like A-list at this point, but still.
Colin Farrell,
I don't know, he shows up in a lot of weird stuff, so.
Yeah.
Depends on how deeply you want to categorize it. Right. I feel like if it was just A, B, C, D, I don't think you can say it's B-list, but... He would probably be A minus list if you're willing to categorize it that way, or B plus list. Yeah,
right. I mean, I feel like, you know, it's sort of like big movie stars like Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise, they never show up in like just some weird random movie. They're only shooting for the fences every time, and I feel like Colin Farrell's a lot more willing to just like do some random shit like this movie, which is about Anthony Hopkins plays a psychic detective who is trying to find a equally psychic serial killer. And so the plot is that they're trying to out-psychic each other.
Oh, nice.
As soon as you said psychic detective, I was like, oh boy, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah, so...
If only they lived on two equivalent Earths with opposing gravity. Yep. It could be a perfect movie.
And yeah, I was telling Ruben also that it is almost a a movie that could be like an upside down thing, except it's kind of like pretty boring in certain parts and not. But Anthony Hopkins definitely gives a very upside down performance. It's a lot of like staring at people and like doing weird eye gestures that that like they could have done 50 takes and he would do the exact same movements with his eyes every time. He's like, oh, this is what I'm gonna do in this scene. Move my eyes here, then down, then look at you and say something serious. But yeah, I don't know. It's pretty bad. I wasn't really expecting it to be very good, but I saw Colin Farrell on the cover and I was like, I do like Colin Farrell. I mean, he's fine in it. He's not in it very much compared to his presence on the cover. It's a lot more Jeffrey Dean Morgan and Abbie Cornish, who's terrible in it. Like, she, I don't know, something like, it feels like every scene she's like in a theatrical play, but not just like with her face, but with like how loud she's talking. It seems like she's like trying to make sure like somebody back in the back pews can hear her say these lines that she's just saying to a person right next to her. It's very baffling.
She thinks she's at a concert film secretly.
Yeah, they couldn't
playing
afford
to
any
the back
boom
of the
mics.
Audience.
All shotguns connected to the cameras. Right.
Does she ever say "Hello, Cleveland" at any point?
Right. Well,
so, yeah, that's my movie.
Yeah. When you said that, you know, well, you do like Colin Farrell, and then you're not watching this shitty movie, that reminded me of when I watched the movie Leap Year, because Adam Scott was in it, and I was just like, yep.
My, the romantic comedy.
Yeah. I
don't even remember him in that movie.
I wrote a very short review of it on Letterboxd. Talking about how my love for Adam Scott takes me to some desperate places in film watching.
Did you see The Overnight?
I never watched The Overnight. I'm starting to not watch Adam Scott movies because
you finally learned
they're very rarely
you're like,
any good.
Hot Tub Time Machine 2? No, thank you.
Yeah, somehow missed
ACOD? I don't know.
Yeah. So I started to watch a movie that might actually also be a pretty good nominee for the Upside Down Award, which is Triple X... two, I guess, or three. I don't know.
Three. The Return of Xander Cage?
Yes.
Or is it State of the Union?
The one that came out this year?
This year. Yeah.
Okay, three. Yeah.
But then I almost thought, like, I stopped the movie because I kind of was not quite feeling it. And also, it kind of felt like the movie knew somehow that it was an upside down movie, if that makes any sense. Like, it's almost so aware of how, like, obviously weird and like goofy it is
to me. That discounts it in a way. Like, they have to drive hard seriously into a premise that is extremely ridiculous, so that's why like something like Troll 2 would never be applicable, because it's made intentionally to disconcert viewers.
Yes. Sure,
to put it lightly.
Yeah. So I ended up rewatching Edge of Tomorrow instead, and it's still such a good movie. I am so glad I put it at the top of my list for 2014, because, like, man, is it still so good. It's just so great. And, like, with Bill Paxton's passing, it's a couple of weeks ago, I think, at this point. But nevertheless, like, sure, great. Like, role for him, also one of the last roles I guess that he got to play in, and he's great in it, and movie's still really, really wonderful, and has not lost any of its like smartness or like any of the way in which it's really well edited, and makes it so fun to rewatch also, because watching the movie itself is kind of like rewatching scenes over and over, so rewatching the movie does not, you know, it actually feels kind of easier than most others. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Really cool.
Nice. And wait.
When I rewatched it, I moved it up my list, but it will probably never be able to make it to the top of 2014, because my 2014 list is stacked. It would have been my number one movie last year, and it would have been... maybe three in 2015, but 2014 had Snowpiercer, Clouds of Sils Maria,
and
2 Days, One
and
Night,
Under the Skin.
And, moved Under the Skin down to like nine, and The Babadook, all of which I like better than.
Is that are we just going to keep rewatching that movie until it's all of our favorite movie? Like, it's just we're just stuck in a time loop where we keep watching it until we love it so much.
Yeah, I rewatched it and bumped it up to 4 stars from 3.5, so it's on
watch,
the way.
Watch, die, repeat.
I mean, that's kind of what happened with me in Tangled. I'm pretty sure when I walked out of the theater, I was like a 3.5 or 4-star movie. It just kept creeping its way up my list the more I watched it.
So it grew on you?
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about this movie.
Hey, Rubens.
No.
Our favorite movies of 1937.
That's it. Well, I was hoping to pick like I could herald or denounce something, and I was hoping that based off the three of you that I would pick, you know, something to even it out, but now we have one herald and one denouncement, so I don't know what to pick. So do you guys want to hear a herald or a denouncement?
Ooh, let's flip a coin. Patrick should pick
Let's hear a herald.
Okay.
Just positivity.
I watched a movie directed by the Dardens called The Kid with the Bike.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Which is a movie about a kid with a bike.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a much more appropriate title than 2 Days, One Night, even though I slightly prefer that movie, in spite of its title making no sense. You know, like I said to Basil over chat, it's, I feel like when I like a Darden movie that I can probably say a lot of the same things, like in terms of how they get actors to perform. There's a certain way in which they work with other actors and move with objects that is just so immersive to me that it's kind of like I'm not even like thinking, I guess, about the moment. And this was one of a movies that I was reviewing live, as it were, which was just writing down things I liked and things I didn't like about it on Letterboxd as I went. And I still found myself like pretty zoned in on the film. There are two moments that really stand out to me with the kid. One, early on, the movie opens with him trying to reach his dad. But as the, like, I guess, sort of child protection services place keeps trying to tell him, his dad has moved out of the apartment and he isn't coming back. And the kid's like holding the phone up to his like head with like two hands in like a way where he can like barely cradle it. Like it seems like really big. And I was like, seems very both kid-like and like syncs up with my feelings on the moment. In itself, like this is a thing that's too weighty for a kid to handle.
Right.
And then there's another part where they go to the abandoned apartment and the super is going to let him in so that they can prove that his dad isn't living there anymore. And he's just like staring at the keyhole, like he can't wait for the door to be opened and get inside and see his dad. That people have all been lying to him that his dad hasn't left or whatever. So yeah, it's a pretty cool movie. I liked it.
Sounds cool.
yeah, it's definitely a little more distressing than 2 Days, One Night was.
Right.
Yeah,
in my opinion. But then again, it was probably less distressing than The Sun. So, of the four Darden films that I've seen,
tear distressing.
2 days, 2 days, One Night is by far the most optimistic.
Right.
And that's not particularly optimistic.
Yeah, that is a talent, being able to be optimistic about really dire situations.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'd like to rewatch
now.
It. I saw it in the theater, but I don't remember it, really.
I don't think it's considered one of their better films, but...
Rosenbaum loves it. I think it was on his, like, best of the decade so far list or something.
All right, well, let's talk about Mannequin, guys.
Yeah.
Borzage.
Yeah, so I guess I'll give you the plot since this was my
plan. Yeah, you will.
Yeah, so oh my gosh, what is her name? Jessie, that's her name. Okay, so it's about Joan Crawford, who plays a character named Jessie, and she's kind of a what's the street they live on? Hester Street, where apparently it's like it's where like poor people live basically, and she works in a factory and she's. You know, her family's down on their luck, and she, kind of says that she, like, wants to get out of there and get away, and she's seeing this guy named, what's his name, Johnny?
Eddie.
Or Eddie, that's right, Eddie. And basically one night after they have, like, a really nice date, she's like, marry me, let's get out of here. And so they get married, and, at their wedding dinner, they're like, they're like really low-rent wedding dinner that they're having at this place, they run into Spencer Tracy, who's like a big, powerful union boss, and he buys them champagne for their wedding because he's like kind of taken with the, the rags to richesness of it. And because he apparently came from Hester Street also, but then he they like go over and say thank you, and when they do, he basically like falls in love with Joan Crawford, and they sort of go through this whole thing where he keeps trying to sort of court her even though she's married to this other guy. And then at a certain point, Eddie, who Joan Crawford's married to, basically like cooks up a plot to have her like leave him and go marry Spencer Tracy, and then like divorce Spencer Tracy and get all his money. But you know, it really, when that's revealed to Joan Crawford, she's basically like, you know, like, fuck you, you're a heel, I'm out of here. And she leaves him, and you know, her and Spencer Tracy end up together. Basically, that's kind of how the whole story goes. Oh, and Spencer Tracy ends up losing all his money anyway at the end, so they're kind of back to square one on that angle. But yeah, that's basically the way the romance goes in this movie.
Is he a union boss?
No.
He owns a shipyard, I guess. But the whole movie is centered around unions, because like in the context of the movie, we're supposed to believe that he's the good capitalist who treats his wage workers well, but they've decided to band together with the other people in the shipyard who aren't treated as well with the union and go universally on strike. And that's, he's like, I'm, you know, living day to day, essentially. My business, you know, will end, and I won't have jobs for you if you keep striking.
Right. Okay, I misunderstood the scene at the beginning where he's meeting with all the people, because I thought that was like... Mm.
It is a union meeting, but he's the boss.
He's just the boss of the shipyard. He's not the union boss. Okay. Yeah. That's what confused me, because I was like, oh, he's here with all the union workers. Like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, and I think he owns actually like the ships themselves rather than the yard. Like,
That's right. Yeah.
Shipping boats.
Okay. Yeah. So a little slight plot confusion, but yeah, that's basically it.
I don't know how I feel about this movie. There are certain things that I liked about it kind of a lot, and then other things that I didn't like kind of a lot, and I don't know where I ended up. It's an odd feeling, because there are certain moments where I was like, wow, this is cool, and then other parts where I was like, ugh, I don't like this at all. So, Ilya?
Yeah, those parts that weren't so good to me, they outweighed the good parts by a lot. So I'd say the only good parts of it was everything having to do with like strangely progressive ideas of female empowerment, and like ideas of I guess like also like some idea of like, yeah, this I guess could be a sympathetic, realist view of how like people in poverty might have to think or act in order to like get by and things like that. But it also espouses like this very strangely idealistic view of like this, actually, you know, in a way, like this kind of like, I think, deeply American optimistic idea of capitalists, of the capitalist good guy, like Ruben said earlier, who, like, you know, you can trust him because he really cares about his workers. You know, he's going to have those meetings with them, and he's going to, you know, reach in his pocket and give somebody $100 if his family's hungry, you know, and he's not even going to ask. He's not, you don't have to beg him. He'll just be there and he'll give it to you. And it's not like, you know, the whole story of how he gets Joan Crawford is like because he just sees her and thinks like, well he gets things, you know, he can get her, why not, like why shouldn't he, he's got everything else,
too, right?
Why shouldn't he get her? And her stupid poor like idiot husband, fuck him. Like, and so,
well, I'm kind of there with him on that.
Fair enough.
That guy is kind of an idiot.
But also, like, you know, and then like the part where he stops the elevator and then like makes it go back up so he can get back in, and then like that he kind of follows her, stalks her all the way to her apartment, like all this shit, like, and it's like supposed to be really charming and weird. And like, I do not think this is charming at all. Fuck Spencer Tracy's stupid face. I don't care. So, yeah. I didn't like this movie.
I like this movie. Mm-hmm. Not a lot, but mostly because of the lighting, which I was surprised that no one has mentioned so far, because I think it has a really crisp and awesome look, and I just really liked looking at a lot of the scenes, especially scenes inside at night. I agree with Ilya about its feelings on capitalism, as you can guess from my tone earlier when I was talking about the guy. But I would say that the one thing that kind of softens it for me that I sort of like is that the movie is, what's the word I'm looking for? Very on the side of women marrying for money, because like it's never particularly clear whether or not Joan Crawford's character loves Spencer Tracy's character, or if she just marries him because he loves her. But like, her mom as sort of like a figure of a possible future of sadness if she stays married to that other guy is like, don't marry a poor guy for love because they're shit. It's okay to marry a rich guy for not love, because
you gotta look out
then
for
your
yourself.
Life will, you know, be, yeah, you know, comfortable, if not like passionate. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, ostensibly okay with that, even if I'm not okay with Spencer Tracy's character or the weird sort of goodness the film tries to put on him at various moments.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about the Busby Berkeley Gold Diggers movies. Like, I was like, I wonder at what point gold digging turned into a pejorative, because these movies are very pro-gold digging.
Yeah.
Moving on up, moving on up.
Yeah, I also liked this movie, but it's almost, has almost everything to do with Joan Crawford and Spencer Tracy. I like their performances. Even though I don't like Spencer Tracy's character, like, I like his performance of it, because he actually does kind of sell me on the, like, goodness of this guy, even though I'm like, yeah, that's probably a lot of bullshit anyway, but I'm like, no, I actually do kind of like him. He is kind of charming, and I really like Joan Crawford in this movie. And I think I'm pretty sold on Joan Crawford just in general at this point. Like, I, you know, she, that whatever that movie star quality is, like, she's got it, like, in spades. Like, she is
just like Clara Bow.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's like I could watch her, you know, like, read the phone book at this point. But I read a review on Letterboxd that somebody wrote about this, where they said this is like a weirdly like right wing but also feminist movie, which they were like confused by. They were like, this is so strange. And like, I guess there was a point in, you know, popular culture where that sort of thing like could exist together, where it's like, women are strong, but also capitalism is good and unions are bad. And it's like,
okay. We have a long tradition of that type of film on this podcast with Blonde Venus, yeah, and Stella Dallas.
And this. Yeah. And, you know, I'm actually maybe like rethinking my position on Blonde Venus at this point, because I'm like, I can still like a movie that has both of these things, because I can like really like the actress who's playing the main character, but also kind of hate all of the politics of the movie. And, you know, it also is a movie that sort of like posits that, like, you know, this guy's just poor because he's lazy or whatever, you know, like the dad, it's just like, he just won't get out of his chair. He's just a lazy person. It's like, you know,
or evil,
or evil. Yeah. In the case of Eddie. Yeah. He's just,
heel. Cause the guy who's rich was poor to start with and then became rich because he was such a good person.
Right.
But the other poor people are lazy or evil.
Right, right. So, you know, the complex morality of real life does not apply here. But,
yeah,
you know, I still think that there are a lot of scenes that are structured really nicely, and I love like how snappy most of the dialogue is. I love the scene where Joan Crawford like smacks Spencer Tracy in the face. I love the scene where Spencer Tracy's like talking to his like right hand man, but he's trying to box that other guy while he's talking, and the guy keeps like hitting him in the face, and then he just gets angry and just punches the guy and knocks him on the ground. And I was like, these are some really fun like constructions of scenes, and yeah, I enjoyed all of that. Like, I enjoyed the machinations of the film, while at the same time like disagreeing with a lot of its thematic content.
I was gonna say, I sort of like, there's a part where I was like, oh, I wish the movie was complicated enough to handle this, because this is actually a fun point where Eddie's talking to her and he's talking about being a kid and how she always saved her pennies to go to the movie theaters and he would just sneak in the back, and he's like, you always told me that was wrong, but I got in, didn't I? And I was like, I mean, in a way, like, you know, it's only because of like a weird capitalist society that we are like, oh, you gotta pay for this thing that everyone should be able to enjoy, which is movies.
Yeah. Although in the ideology of this movie, that would definitely make him evil, which plays into the
evil
person in this movie. That's basically
what,
so.
But that's you didn't hear what Basil said. He said, "I wish the movie was able to deal with this complex point, but it didn't."
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. The idea is that the movie treats that not as a complex point, but like he did that and that made him evil. Gradually not being a good capitalist made him be like an evil poor person. That's what it turned out to be.
Or even that he was just born evil or something. Like, I don't know. Like, that's why people are poor, because they're born evil, because they're just they're just never going to fit in society, and that's why we need to throw them in prison and get them away from regular nice people or whatever.
Yeah.
I like that he doesn't have a change of heart, though. That made me feel really good. Like, he shows up, and he's all nice, and I was like, what is this? And then he's like, ah, I know you're broke. Bye.
What I was going to say was I essentially agree with Patrick's point about the fact that Spencer Tracy is such sort of like a genuinely likable actor that he makes you want to like this character. But to me, my response to that is, ew, gross. No, thank you. Like, it makes me like the movie less that they cast someone as genuinely likable as Spencer Tracy.
Yeah.
In this
The movie really wants you to like him, right?
Yeah, like, to the thematic points of the movie, where it's like, yeah, whoever came up with this story, like, definitely has some issues, you know, that they they should have examined, I guess, back in 1937 about their own lives. But, like, it is, it is definitely, like, some capitalist propaganda where it's like, we're going to hire the most likable guy that we can find to play this, you know, super nice
capitalist.
I'm not
even sure if issues is the right word, since it's such a core American myth.
Yeah, that's true. It's not even
riding the status quo.
Yeah,
idea is still why, like, you know, the top 1% does not pay any taxes. It's just like, oh, because you know, deep down they're actually like they you know, they deserve it. You know, they deserve all that money.
Yeah, I mean,
and like,
Paul Ryan, they're encouraging poor people to, you know, work harder so that they can get some of that money. Yeah. By dangling it just out of their reach.
Yeah, for sure.
Delicious carrots.
Other than those two and the acting department, though, I found this movie very disconcerting and made it a lot harder for me to enjoy the parts that I didn't enjoy. I already sort of mentioned it off cast, but the younger brother of John Crawford's character gives a very interesting performance, to put it in the nicest way possible. He's kind of hunched over the whole film, and he like often has both of his arms out like he's a marionette, and like walks really weirdly and talks in a way that no human ever has. And I'm like, what exactly is happening here? Is he like supposed to be playing a small child, but is a full-grown adult and doesn't know how to do that? Like, I'm very confused by how strange this performance is. Like, I can imagine it working in like a different film, like a Jan Svankmajer film. Not so much like a 1930s melodrama.
Yeah. Like, it's just there to make it like clear that she, how much she wants to leave that place. Okay. Like, it's so bad here, and you can't, like, you've met my brother audience for like 5 seconds, and you do not want to spend a single minute longer with him, and I've lived here my whole life, so you understand why I want to run out, right? Basically.
Earlier I was saying that actor was, he looked like he was one of the dead end kids, and I was correct. He is one of the dead end kids that he basically like played that sort of character all the time, where he was like, you know, he was like a little like, you know, rapscallion. He was a little like street urchin kid in, I
like
think,
Fievel.
Was it like there were seven Fievel. Dead end kids movies apparently. From, what was it, 37 to 39. So, yeah, that's actually, like, a part that actor played a lot.
Nice. I was going to say that it's a real missed opportunity for the movie a little bit because, like, one of his purposes, at least, is to, like, make his dad look foolish. Like, every time the dad says something, it cuts to him, and he's making some kind of, like, snarky remark. And I was like, oh, this would be kind of cool if his, like, not fitting in the movie was some kind of, like, subversive element. But, like, he doesn't fit in because he says even more conservative stuff instead of, like, being, like, the voice of, like, the eye-rolling, like, you know, radical or whatever. Instead, he's like, ugh, like, you're not enough of a man, Dad. Like, you're worthless to me. That's a bummer.
I also found, what was his name, Eddie? Is that her husband's name?
Yeah, Eddie. Mm.
I found his performance not as disconcerting, but still disconcerting, in that he was basically like, watched Little Caesar, and they were like, just do this. And he was like, okay. And I was like, well, is he a gangster? Is he going to become a gangster? No, he's just gonna sit at the house.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he had like a kind of interesting role, so like it was really kind of unfortunate that the acting was not very good on that side.
Yeah, but in a way, that almost makes me like the movie more because it feels like Joan Crawford and Spencer Tracy literally don't fit in this world because they're the only good actors in it. Like, it's like here's two real human people surrounded by. By mannequins, maybe. Maybe that's the...
Yeah, the title comes from Joan Crawford, like, literally having a job as a mannequin. Or, like, I guess what we would call a model today. Mm-hmm. But they referred to them as mannequins, where she's like... That was another scene that I liked. Yeah, where she's, like, she's modeling the clothes, and, like, every time she walks up to Spencer Tracy, he says something to her, and she's like, no! Like, every time. And then the last time, before he says anything, she just goes, no!
But then that's the part where they connect, which I did not like. I was like, aw, I was on board for this until this point. I also like that, like, the last thing is boudoir clothes, and they're, like, the least nude of all the clothes that they're wearing. Better bundle up for the boudoir.
I was happy that scene was there. Not so much for the film itself, but so that I understood the context of that scene in Singing in the Rain, because the same scene mm-hmm. exists where the guy is singing and all the women are wearing the different clothes, and I'm like, oh, this is like a thing that happened in the 30s, mm-hmm. that Singing in the Rain is referencing / mocking.
Right. The 30s were...
just have
fun.
Fashion shows. Yeah, fashion shows at stores. Just show up. There's a fashion show.
Yeah. Sadly, Singing in the Rain is only mocking the idea of wearing, like, really bougie clothes, like, informal stuff, and not mocking, like, the sexualization of young women, since one of the lines in that song is, like, about how great it is that she's sweet 16.
Yeah.
And she's only sweet 16. And I'm like, what? Man. That's not a positive.
Oh, boy.
It's a great tradition in pop culture.
So that, phrase, that is true, yeah.
That phrase still exists in, like, American culture, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's still a thing.
I mean, I don't know if that show is still on, but I mean, like, it's, my super sweet 16 is definitely still a thing.
Yeah.
Recently.
I mean, 16 is traditionally, at least in the South, like, when a woman has, like, her first debutante ball and is introduced to society as, like, a potential dating prospect, although she then dates people close to her own age, whereas the guy singing that song is an adult man. Yeah. But it is a very weird tradition. A
debutante ball. That sounds pretty cool.
I mean, dancing is fun, and, you know, walking around in fancy clothes is fun. I like all that stuff. I just have a little bit of weirdness with any sort of tradition that tells you, okay, the day before this happened, you were a child, and the day after this happened, you were an adult.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not really how maturity works. And when people become obsessed with those really clear lines, you get really gross stuff like countdowns to young actresses turning 18.
Right.
And I'm like, ugh.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And barely legal porn. They're legal, but barely.
Just barely. Just minutes. Just minutes legal.
The more they're like a child, don't you like that?
But.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, we should push all those ages up at least. I don't know. Like, bar mitzvah, have that at like 21 now. You don't need that at age 13.
Just push him, like, way later. It's more fun. Like, what are you looking forward to when you're, like, 39? Like,
that's true.
Right?
Woo!
Finally. God. It's totally worth it, surviving about, this long.
The only thing I could say about the Jewish tradition is there actually is a ceremony. It's 6, 13, and 18. So it's recognizing that there are actually multiple stages
of maturity
to growing up. Yeah. But then it also, it stops at 18.
Yep. Man, yeah, we got to get this going. Like, 35, be like, just,
yeah,
we got there.
It's like, it's okay to objectify me day. Like,
yeah.
At 35, like, objectify the shit out of me. It's okay.
What if, wait for it, you continue to learn and mature every day of your life until you die.
Maybe you do.
I'm in a Seth Rogen movie. I'm gonna smoke weed and sell the time codes of celebrity nudity in films. One of the best parts of that movie is how much Paul Rudd looks like the Mr. Skin icon. He's doing the impression of it.
Oh, man.
But yeah, was no one else with me on the lighting thing? No one said anything.
Oh,
I don't know. No, I mean, I was really tired when I watched this movie, so. Because I watched it this morning as soon as I woke up.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that in the early scenes, where she's in the kitchen with the mom, like, cleaning stuff, I was like, oh, there's some cool, like, because it looks like the light's, like, coming in through the windows, like, the city around them, and I was like, oh, this looks kind of neat. And then there's another shot right when she comes and, like, hugs Eddie and is like, let's get married, and then there's, like, she, like, pulls away from him, and there's, like, the shadow over, like, half of her face, and I was like, that's a really weird shot to have in a scene.
Yeah,
where
right after that first scene at her family's, right? And she
where she runs back down the stairs,
to go on a date with him. Yeah,
I was.
Yeah, that was the very scene that stood out to me as, like, being the best.
Like, yeah,
scene.
I was like, that's an interesting way to show somebody, like asking someone to marry them. Like, here's like their face, like, half hidden in shadow. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow.
That's why I specify that, like, I mean, it's not that I dislike the lighting in the other scenes, but the scenes that take place at night inside do a lot of things that I feel like I don't see that much before, where it's willing to like play with some parts of the screen being lit and some parts not. Like that other part that you mentioned, like her mom and her in the kitchen, and they're lit fairly well, like you can see everything in the kitchen, and then there's a fairly long space of darkness in the apartment to where there's just, I don't know if it's a spotlight or just, you know, one light shining on the dad, like in the background. I was like, oh, this is lit more like a play would be, like this is sort of moody and metaphorical as opposed to like realistic.
Yeah, like that dark gulf between them.
It's true.
It's really cool. Yeah, I for as much as, you know, like interior soundstage sets can look not at all like the thing they're trying to portray, I definitely think that this movie like gets those right in a lot of spaces and like makes them look even cooler than they probably would in a real, you know, like rundown apartment like that.
I like how long the stairs are.
Oh yeah. They definitely
to get up to the second
floor. Yeah, they definitely like get a lot of feels. They definitely get a lot of mileage out of her like walking by that door with the crying baby and like the light that she like touches on the wall every time, because I was like, oh, this is an interesting like little exercise they have her do, kind of back and forth.
But it feels like she has to walk forever to get to the front door and then walk forever again once she goes in the front door to get to the second floor. Mm-hmm. And I like that.
Yeah.
But I like sets in general. I mentioned that in my Wizard of Oz review. I don't remember which viewing of it that I noticed that, like, how phony looking Kansas is in that movie. But it's something that I really enjoy about the movie is how much it looks like a set.
Because it's supposed to be.
Nope.
Yeah. Home can be.
It's all digital, baby.
But yeah, I don't really have anything else to say about this movie.
I like a lot of the idioms, similar to Ruggles of Red Gap. I like when, even though the character is annoying, I like when the younger brother says that Eddie's a false alarm. He's like, I can see that guy's a false alarm.
What does that mean?
Not worth running outside with your pets for.
Exactly.
I think the woman who plays Joan Crawford's friend in the review that she plays in also has a couple of those aimed at Eddie, I think, at some point. There's that scene where she kind of like makes fun of him for like being like a totally obvious like douchebag.
Yeah.
And, like,
he's a big old mooch.
Yeah, and I like her character actually kind of a lot in this movie.
I was going to say, she's kind of a stock character I'd forgotten to think about her, but maybe one of my favorite stock characters is the, like, bored with the world, like, friend. Mm-hmm. And it almost made me, like, in a very tiny way, made me think of, like, Showgirls.
Yeah.
And just, like, the exhaustion with this society.
Yeah, that's a character that's kind of disappeared, because I feel like nowadays whenever there's, like, the bored with it friend in a romantic comedy type thing, that person also finds somebody eventually to be like, yeah, like, never mind, I was cynical about the world, but it was only because I hadn't met my true heteronormative partner yet.
Well, in this movie, she ends up, like, confirming Zach Hennessy is such a great guy, like, when you know, they go on this vacation and she's on it with them. I didn't quite understand, but, like, they're somewhere in Europe and, like, she's with them, and then they give her, like, an envelope with money or something. I didn't quite understand what that was.
But again,
she's like, oh, you're swell, like, and then she disappears.
I disagree with the capitalist element of that, but if you live in a capitalist society, like, what she says in that moment is like her like of him is bought, like literally bought. She's like, I don't like the guys you date. Envelope full of cash. I like this one. I'm like, fair enough. Yep. If you're gonna live in a capitalist hell, you might as well sell your feelings.
Sell everything. Why not?
I'm hearing an echo. Is anyone else hearing an echo?
Oh, I bet.
I think it's Patrick's...
Yeah, he set his headphones too close to his mic when he got up.
Yeah.
Good one, Patty. I like when he says, what do you say we go to Egypt and buy snakes? I was like, that's a weird... that's like the draw of Egypt. It's like, we can buy snakes there.
Shows that he's not a very refined rich guy. He's like, yeah, let's do something weird where...
Sounds fun.
What's in Egypt? Aren't there snakes? Let's go buy some.
Go to Bucharest. It's a fun word to say.
The movie, I can't remember the title of it. The movie that I blackballed from this list because I had seen it with Joan Crawford, I realize now is like a very similar plot because it's a love triangle. And I think it has Henry Fonda in it.
Adam's Rib?
Although he...
No, that's... No. Katharine Hepburn. Whoops.
I think it might be an Otto Preminger film. I'm not positive. But it's a love triangle film, and I just remembered that there's also a scene taking place in like a rural type cabin between her and Henry Fonda, who's like the good love interest in the film, and like it's very sweet. And I'm like, man, they were really feeling those, what are they called, paintings? Norman
Rockwell?
Rockwell,
yeah.
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 Americana, man.
Totally unironically.
Yep.
After you watch a movie like this, you gotta watch a movie like Cabin Fever.
Right.
Like, wash all that nonsense out of your brain.
It's too bad. I mean, it feels like sad that I feel like in a way we've almost regressed since then. I mean, we have regressed a lot. Like, this is like a pretty pro-capitalist movement, but at least he does like unions. Like, you know, it's hard to imagine Tom Hanks's capitalist guy in, like, he feels bad that they're putting other businesses out of business, but not enough to stop doing it. Like, I can't imagine Tom Hanks and You've Got Mail being like, all right, let's get the union together, figure out what we need to give these people.
Yep. Yeah.
There's a chart that I saw, and, you know, always with the caveat that correlation does not equal causation. But basically, there's, you know, top wages and low wages, and they're getting closer as unions get stronger. And then there's a point in, like, I think the 70s when they start breaking up the unions, and it immediately starts going the other way. And it's like, I wonder if unions had anything to do with that.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I blame on the waterfront.
Yeah. Fuck you, Kazan.
Fucking Elio Kazan. Not only did he ruin a bunch of people's careers, he made the hellhole that is capitalism worse for everyone.
Yep.
It's like, and I just can't imagine that these people who have like $60 billion would be like that sad if like $4 billion was taken away from them.
Right. But they would.
So sad.
Wouldn't it be weird? Like, don't it strike you as an American that it's so un-American that any person would have $4 billion taken away from them for the government? Man?
I mean, it strikes me as un-American that anyone would have $4 billion to be taken away from them.
I think someone...
That's what strikes me as un-American.
Didn't someone have that tweet or whatever?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was so gross.
You know, one of those dumb conservative pundits was like, isn't it un-American that anyone would have to pay $25 million in taxes?
Like,
talking about Donald Trump.
Like,
and I was like,
man,
first of all, no.
Have to pay.
Like, in fact, if you read that constitution that you supposedly care about, you would know the answer is no.
Yeah.
That they don't approve of monarchs. second answer, that's 1 year in the, like, 45 years that Donald Trump has been in business. And I'm guessing, considering it was stamped like
client copy
by Donald Trump's client copy by Donald Trump's accountant. He leaked it, which means it's the year that he paid the most taxes.
Yeah, exactly. Which year can we plausibly leak which would look the least bad, like, for me?
And even it looks pretty bad because he only paid that much taxes because of a tax that him and other rich people have been trying to get rid of, which is designed
which is what he's doing right now. Evading
all their taxes.
Yeah, which is what he wants to get rid of now. Like, that's pretty cool.
Oh, boy.
See, I paid a lot of taxes because of this rule that I hate and have been trying to get rid of my entire career.
Good stuff.
But, yeah, everything costs money. That's what
they say. Joan Crawford says.
Yeah, that part's pretty sad. I like that part.
Yeah, yeah. No, again, occasionally this movie, that's what I said. I feel like it does have, like, a sympathetic view of, like, people who are like, yeah, fuck. Like, not having money sucks.
Yeah.
Like, what am I gonna fucking do? Like, might as well marry a rich guy, I guess. Whatever. Like, it doesn't really, like... usually, I guess, that sort of scene would play out more as, like... Yeah, there's... I guess the way in which this plays out, like, there's nuance to the type of behavior that's usually generally frowned upon by society, even though, like... put women in the kind of situation where, like, that's often the way that they're taught, like, that's how you have any chance at attaining any wealth or, like, guaranteeing any kind of stable type of security for yourself. And then we tell the same women they're sluts because they're, like, you know, they're like, they have, like, these older men that they're dating, and but you don't even love him. You don't even love him, do you?
That's at least a more recent development. Yeah. Although, I mean...
I don't know.
I know at that time they had other ways of making women feel terrible. There's not a point in history in which society hasn't devised ways to make women feel awful about all of the choices
you could argue that,
that they make.
Like, mistresses of, like, lords and kings or whatever in the Middle Ages were seen as, like, the same way.
Of course, outside of marriage, for sure. But, like, if you were, you know, a lower aristocrat and you married the king, like, that would be a great honor, you know? Yeah. In medieval times, marrying up a class, and only women could do that. Men couldn't, almost never married up class, which is why you sometimes had queens who had no husbands, because there was
no suitable
no one
suitors
to marry them.
But yeah, I don't know. There was a part during that scene when the dad is like, no wife of mine would ever go to work. Like, and I think there's, like, an interesting irony that's, like, would get lost even, like, pretty contemporarily, that, like, the movie's making fun of him a little bit because, like, when it cuts to the wife, she's, like, this haggard, like, sweaty, like, in his mind, housework isn't work, but, like, you know, she's, like, he doesn't work, and she is still doing all the housework or whatever, and I thought that was, like, pretty cool and progressive, because at first when he said it, I was like, oh, and then as soon as it cut to the wife, I was like, oh no, this movie meant that ironically. We're not supposed to agree with that.
Yeah,
and of course Joan Crawford makes all of the income for that household as well. So, like, it's basically like, what are you saying if you're supposed to be preventing your wife from working, but you're okay with your daughter working? Like, there's at least some deep hypocrisy there.
But at the same time, like, I
even
would take,
without the other smarter point,
I would feel like that point would be more salient if the movie didn't, like, also immediately counterpoint it with the idea of, like, Spencer Tracy's patriarch. Like, if this is, like, the kind of patriarchy that doesn't work, he's, like, the kind of patriarch that does work. And except the only main difference between them is, like,
no,
he has a ton of money
under capitalism,
and, like, he can be whoever the fuck he wants, and, like, he, it's cool, it's, you know, it's, like, easy to be nice and give people hundreds of dollars if you have millions of dollars. It's not that hard, you know, it's not hard at all.
But he gives it to that guy even after he's broke. That's how good a person he
is. Exactly. So it's still
it's not posits. That hard, but historically we know that it doesn't happen very often.
Right. It's still true. Posits still patriarchy is the one true right way. You know, it's just like there's you know there's bad ones. You know, they're usually poor, and there's good ones. You know,
The good ones used to be poor, and now they're rich. Yeah. But they appreciate where they came from.
They appreciate where they are.
Of course, no one ever sees the film can't deal with the nature of the other ship owners because they're obviously screwing over their employees, which is why the employees in general are striking. Right. But we never get to see them.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that's the side of capitalism that can't exist in this movie. Yeah.
That's all so gross. That whole scene where he's like, tell me something, like, say something, like, what's bothering you? Nobody's saying anything, because they're like, oh, we're so ashamed, you know, because, like, you're such a good guy, it's all these other fucking guys that are so bad, you know, but you're so good. Can you give, like, I'm my family's hungry, can you give me money? Thank you. That's, the whole scene is so fucking disgusting.
Right. Yep.
There's too much stuff like that that makes me like real angry. Where it's like,
yeah,
all the cool, weird, interesting stuff this movie says is just like washed away. You know.
Yeah. So, yeah. I just really like lighting. So when the fair enough. Movie is lit well. it's got to be real regressive for me to actually hate it. Yep. And in fact,
yeah.
One of the movies I could have denounced, a film called No, directed by Pablo Larraín, is a movie that I think is like pretty smart, but looks so ugly that I couldn't like it at all.
Yeah.
Like, not only were they going for like a sort of Paul Greengrassy, like in the moment, like documentary faux realism, which is like pretty nauseating to begin with, but they shot it on like all cameras I think that would have been available to people at that time, like VHS cameras, and I'm like, whoa, this is real ugly. Like, I thought only part of the film was going to look that way, but then the whole film looked that way, and I was like, oh no, this is intolerable. Which is especially weird because one of the sort of tensions in the movie is the idea that like sometimes the idea isn't enough, because like the movie is about like a debate between Gael García Bernal's character, who's like a marketing expert and like knows how to sell things, and then like the leftist politicians who are like, all the tragedy that Pinochet has done is enough, and he's like, no, it's not enough. You're gonna have to come up with your own better propaganda to make him look bad if you really want to win this vote. And they're like, no, just list the dead bodies, and he's like, that's really not gonna work. And very relevant to the last American election and Democrats' belief that just like listing Donald Trump's bad qualities would be enough.
Yeah, just like not, yeah, just staying out, like being like, oh, look at all the traditions that he's bucking, and it's like, no, like nobody cares and about not those actually, traditions.
Not actually marketing their candidate as being like a better option. Yeah.
It's amazing that they didn't realize that wouldn't work when it didn't work like 12 years ago with John Kerry. John Kerry's whole platform was just like, I'm not George Bush. Remember how awful the last 4 years of George Bush have been? And then he lost because it wasn't enough.
I'd have to look up the history, but like, there's a fairly long history in both parties of when they don't have like a super great new candidate to run, of just running the person who came in second last time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that person has ever won when they've done that. Like, they shouldn't just never do that.
Yeah.
No one is like, yeah, maybe the person who came in second, they're good enough.
America loves winners.
It's done. It's like, you know who we'd really like to be president? The person who lost to Barack Obama. an unknown senator.
Yeah.
She really wanted it, though.
Yeah.
Mm. And she's got a lot of friends.
She almost lost. She almost lost to an unknown senator again. It's pretty amazing. And he didn't even have any money. Like, Obama at least had money.
Right.
Bernie Sanders was like broke. He's rich now, but like when he started campaigning, he was like, "I got $50. What can I do?"
He's got like holes in his jacket.
Yeah, Hannibal Burris had a funny joke about how Bernie would be the first person to get the presidential salary and be excited about it. Like, fuck yeah. We're going to get an extra big grill on our deck.
Oh, man, that's such a weirdly sad truth. Yeah, fuck. Nobody's excited about $100,000 whatever dollars.
Yeah, I remember people were talking about if Bernie Sanders had won, that he'd be the first Jewish, I guess culturally, and the first atheist, even though not admittedly, president. But more importantly, he'd be the first poor president. The first, like, actually genuinely poor president who had just worked his entire life in the public office.
Right.
Like, would be making, like, $45,000 a year as the mayor of Burlington.
It would be funny if, like, once he became president, he just started, like, just throwing cash all over the place and, like, being, like, completely responsible with money. Just like, guys, this is awesome.
We have $400,000. Look what I can buy.
He rolls into this first State of the Union wearing a gold top hat.
Looks like the guy from Monopoly.
There's another great tweet about Bernie Sanders that was like, Bernie Sanders is that guy in the movie, the scientist in the movie that no one trusts because he's wearing too big of a suit and his hair looks crazy. Even though he's right that the aliens are coming or the world is ending or whatever. No one believes him.
He's like Brett Spiner's character from Independence Day.
Yeah, I was going to say, essentially what they should have done is they should have just had Bernie Sanders like stand behind Jeff Goldblum and like feed him lines. Because we know, based on Jurassic Park and Independence Day, if Jeff Goldblum is feeding the lines, people listen.
That's true.
He's a scientist people trust. Rockstar scientist. Yeah.
That's democratic socialism.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have to go because my model is here for my photo shoot now, and it's
all right.
Ready. Yeah, it's all so good.
You guys can
wrapping up here.
I mean, we're obviously done talking about the movie, so we can say thanks for listening, everybody. Yes. I hope you enjoyed it. If so, you should subscribe to our podcast using your podcast listening application. Give us one of those ratings and reviews on iTunes, preferably 5 stars, but you know, you do you. And I'm pulling up and tune in next time. We will be discussing Duel
by Jacques Rivette.
And I also wanted to shout out our message board that we just started, loosecannonspodcast.boards.net. So check that out. If you want to actually have some discussion with us, you can reach us directly on the message board.
Oh, and also, whenever I say whatever podcast that we're doing next, that's of the planned podcast. But as listeners know, we sometimes do new movies, so based on when this one might come out, we might have actually be doing Ghost in the Shell next or Ghost in the Shell right before this.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we're doing Ghost in the Shell
will be around that time. But
yes.
Yeah. So we don't know exactly where those podcasts will fall in the order based on when things get recorded, when things get released. But
yep. So watch both
the next
movies.
Planned podcast is Duel.
Yes.
But watch Ghost in the Shell too.
Yeah. We'll also be discussing Ghost in the Shell shortly after it is released.
All right.
All right, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking either that or the one right after where she tells off Spencer Tracy and says that her mother wasted a lifetime of strength.
Did she tell
to
off
prove that women were weak?
Spencer Tracy or the young guy?
Oh, no, wait, yeah, she tells Eddie.
Yeah, it's Eddie. Alan Curtis, Eddie. Yeah.
Colin Curtis.
Yeah.
The brother of Adam Curtis.
Yep.
The younger brother of Adam Curtis.
But not Adam Curtis, the documentary director. Adam Curtis, the director of... what was the name of that film you watched? Trespass Against Us?
Okay. That's Adam Smith.
Isn't that also?
That's Adam Smith.
Oh, that's Adam Smith.
Oh, it's Adam Smith. The
free economy.
Writer of Wealth of Nations.
he's their stepdad.
Laissez-faire economics.
They took his name.
And very bad thrillers.
Oh, God.